Hello, everybody, and welcome again to Back to the Future. Yes, the podcast that chats to the innovators of today who are making tomorrow happen. And making tomorrow happen with me this week is Dacher Keltner. Dacher, you're very welcome.
Oh, it's good to be here, Martin, really.
Now, I just wanted to explain to people, you are a professor of psychology at the University of California. So people will know that. It's in Berkeley for those of us listening from the UK. But you're also the faculty director of the Greater Good Science Center.
Yeah.
I think there's a clue there as to what's coming up next, because you have written a book which is called Awe, as in A-W-E. Why did you call the book Awe?
I called the book Awe because that's the central topic of the book, but also awe and the word has a lot of mysteries in it. And it's kind of the central concept that people need to think through what it means to them. And I think the book offers a sort of an exposition of the meaning of the word and everything that comes with it for each person, yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because when you say the word awe, it makes you feel in some ways awesome. And to consider awe both in terms of how it opens you up, makes you think differently. And I think one of the quotes I found in the book, which I felt summed up that kind of question I was thinking about, which is, you know, it's about feeling of being in the presence of something vast. So that point about awe, that transcends your central understanding of the world and your current understanding of the world, really. So if I'm kind of imagining awe in that sense, you know, it's about that great trip to the Arctic, about the higher Himalayas, you know, I'm kind of on a mountain. How do you think that relates to smaller things that potentially the everyday will allow us to encounter? And is it possible for that to create awe in the same way?
Yeah, you know, that was, I think, one of the central discoveries that led to the writing of the book, which is that when we think about awe, we often think of the Northern Lights and Grand Canyons and Taj Mahals. But in point of fact, in different parts of the world, our studies show people feel awe a couple times a week. And you might call it small awe. I called it everyday awe, where observations challenge your sort of expectations about that are operating in that moment. And you might see a leaf fall from a tree or children laughing in duets and suddenly, you know, with the light shining in shadows on the ground. And you have this everyday awe experience. It's not taking you out of the world, if you will, but it's there. And I think the answer to your question, Martin, is yes, this is easy to cultivate and in dire need today, that we need to re-find awe.
I mean, it was fascinating because before I came on the podcast, and I guess because my brain was prompted to think about these things, I was looking out. It's a beautiful crystalline day here in London. Light glinting, and the word liminally came to me on the canal in front of the studio. And it really did occur to me that, gosh, that is awesome in both the profound sense of the word and also in the everyday. And I think one of the things the book taught me was to re-examine everyday things in a more extraordinary and focused and profound way. So I guess, is that one of the things you're asking us to do and to revisit these things in a different plane or a different way or a different sense of being?
Profoundly so. I mean, you know, Descartes really felt, like a lot of people, that awe is a basic state of consciousness. It's a basic way of looking and feeling about the world. And if that's true, what that tells us is ordinary things can bring us awe, and our stories of awe from around the world speak to that, of people being astounded by somebody's generosity on the tube. I heard a story just 2 days ago like that, or walking through a park and there's somebody playing the cello. My hope, and I offer really practical clues, which should be of interest to your audience, is, you know, what are the mindsets of awe? What are the ways to see awe in the ordinary? Like looking to small things and then panning out and looking at the vastness around it. You can find awe in a lot of different things.
Because I guess a lot of people will get the vast point if I think about, you know, to your description of the Milky Way, you know, the Taj Mahal. I mean, the night sky at the moment, because we're going through quite a cold spell here in the UK, and I happen to have a place on the coast, I see the most beautiful and mystical moments in the sky at night. I can't help but being overcome by it. But the question I really want to ask you is there a chemical change happening in my body when I see this? Or is it just my emotions overwhelmingly and therefore I'm feeling transcendental because of this emotional thing? Or is there a chemical at work that potentially is changing me in this profound and different manner?
Yeah, and that's one of the most exciting directions, right? Because, you know, when you think about awe, first of all, it's like, wow, could you even ever measure it? You know, it's so hard to, it's ineffable, it's hard to describe. But in point of fact, you know, there's a new neurophysiology of awe, which, you know, just to give you a couple of highlights, one of them is the default mode network in your brain. It's where self-representation arises and self-criticism. Awe really quiets that egoistic region of the brain down. Another two favorites of mine in the neurophysiology of awe or the chemistry of it is tears and chills. And we emit certain kinds of tears out of the lacrimal glands and chills, which are governed by this old branch of our nervous system called the parasympathetic autonomic nervous system, which really is the antithesis of fight or flight and threat, and it really opens you to the world. So the neurophysiology starts to tell us really deep things about how deeply this emotion is embedded in our psyches and our bodies.
Well, because I actually did a podcast with somebody who you will know, Ivy Ross and Susan Maximin, who were saying pretty much the same things. And they said, you know, one of the things they felt when they met you, because I think they interview you in the book, was how you made them feel that awe was such a profound and brilliant thing. Because they said a lot of the times we take it for granted, because although we, you know, we're on the top of a building looking out onto the skyline, we're by the seashore looking at the horizon. And she, I think it was Ivy who said, actually, we expect to find awe in these things. But what we didn't expect, which is what I think you had told them, was how to find awe in the everyday and that wonder. And they said, I should ask you about this chemical thing, because I think Susan particularly was saying that we forget about the chemistry and the shifts in our brain that chemicals being released cause that help with this uplift. But my question is, if I don't see something that is profound and is transcendental, can I create it from inside? You know, can I imagine this thing and then release the same chemicals and make the same thing happen?
Yeah, and that's where it's a really complicated question, right? Does an image of the Sagrada Familia do the same thing as being there? Or does a memory of seeing a really moving musical performance do the same thing as the performance? And we don't have those comparisons yet scientifically, but what we do have are a lot of studies showing, you know, if I recall, and it's so fascinating, Martin, you know, I ask people this when I teach them, like, think back to your first experience of awe as a child. And what it meant to you. And people think, oh, let me think about it. And next thing you know, out come these stories of, you know, going fishing with a dad or cooking with mom. And another comparable one is to imagine a mentor in your life who really has taught you about moral beauty, which is a source of awe. Those reflections and memories and imaginings trigger a lot of the same neurophysiology, like oxytocin, and also the psychological benefits of
yeah,
awe.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you, because I am somebody who suffers from, I think it's called social anxiety in America. Here it's just called sheer panic. The English always try to make things seem much, much more dangerous and shocking. And I certainly know when I think about something, I feel the same triggers.
Yeah.
And somebody said, why don't you start thinking about awe and those transcendental moments and try to use that to trigger the same sense of openness and the same sense of wonder. Because what I discovered in your book is that awe in itself makes us more risk-friendly and makes us more willing to both try new things, but also to embrace potentially things that maybe we're unsure about, or it's new and unusual, and our system perhaps hasn't woken up to it. So is it sort of a prescription, again, for other parts of our life that we can use on a daily basis to make us better and perhaps less anxious and more open people?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the main reasons I wrote this book. You know, we are coming out of the pandemic, depression, anxiety are up 30%. You know, I was just doing a lot of work during the pandemic and people would be like, what can I do to help my mind and body? And the science on awe is really unequivocal, which is it's good for your heart, it's good for your immune system, it reduces little bursts of awe. even, you know, like just telling stories about awe, another kind of non-immersive way to experience it, reduce stress. And you hit something really fundamental about awe, Martin, is it really at its core is about the human urge to discover, right? And it opens us up and we go seeking new things in awe. And that is important in these times, is to not worry about risks and open our minds to the unknown. And awe, that's the heart of awe. Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, it's what is more amazing is I've just spent quite a lot of time recently speaking to CEOs on one side, and also the people that work with them, their teams, their employees, et cetera. And I'd said to the CEOs, what do you think is most lacking in your corporation or in your organization? And they listed the usual pillars. And I thought, okay, so I'm going to ask the same thing to their teams. And pretty much the majority, with a couple of exceptions, said curiosity or wonder was another term, or a third group said surprise. And I thought, my gosh, if you put those three things together, they would be the great formula for creating a business, a positioning, a sense of value that really is what's missing from the world at the moment. And yet it surprised me that none of the CEOs mentioned that those three words, surprise, curiosity, and wonder. And when I spoke to one of them just before I came in this podcast, I said, I'm about to interview a man about awe. And he said, oh, that's interesting. In a rather dismissive, and it's a marginal thing. I might speak to my well-being team about it, or, you know, the HR. And I thought, oh boy, are you missing the point. And that's just really what I wanted to get you perhaps to talk more about, how awe at its most fundamental, if I could teach it to all of my innovation, my marketing, my media, my CEOs, how different or would it make my business fundamentally different if this was a pillar that they embraced as a core value and not as a nice to have within an organization?
Yeah, and thanks for pressing the case for awe in these different contexts. In the book, I chart many of the incredible discoveries, game-changing discoveries that came out of awe, right? Einstein's thinking and Darwin's thinking about evolution, and Newton and Descartes figured out the physics of rainbows because of awe and wonder, and the discovery of the stars, and so on. And in fact, it will be a book that's written that so much of innovation comes out of awe, right? Just like I'm awestruck by big data and how do I create algorithms that make big data more accessible or whatever. And the science on this is really clear that if you care about curiosity and innovation, awe is a powerful pathway. I do a lot of work in organizations like healthcare settings, and there's so many easy ways to bring it to your organization. You know, tell stories of awe. Think about, I was just meeting with a team at Penguin Publishing, and I was like, talk about a book that gave you the chills, right? And suddenly they got a sense of the purpose of publishing. There's a lot to do to bring this emotion to us.
And it's not Harry's Spare, which I have to say less inspired me with awe and more with annoyance and irritation.
Because awe-inspiring sales.
Yeah, you're right. It is that kind of moment. And one of the things that I was also curious about is that, and I watch you doing it while I'm chatting to you, is that it excites you and it makes you kind of grow, not just in stature, but in terms of mental opportunity and capacity. But is there a sense of fear that sits with it? Because one of the things that occurred to me that sometimes when I'm feeling the awe of nature, of the sea, or of a forest, I can also feel fear within that. And is that part of that kind of combination of emotions I'm meant to feel when awe is at its most active?
Yeah, you know, that was, you know, thank you for asking that question, because that was one of the questions that we've devoted the most scientific attention to. The etymology of awe traces back to 8th and 9th century Norse and Old English, where it was really about fear and dread. And historically, awe has become much more positive. You know, people live longer, there's less torture, et cetera, fewer physical horrors. But about a quarter of awe experiences have significant fear. In religious traditions, you might fear the afterlife. Or I was backpacking with my daughter, and we had this electrical storm pass over us, and it was awe-inspiring until it started hitting local ravines and was dangerous. So yeah, and that's part of the story, is fear is very often nearby. It changes the whole quality of awe, and it's something to be attentive to.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it is that excitement. And you mentioned storms. I was thinking about the electric nature of how awe makes us feel. And I'm wondering, is that a universal feeling? You know, is it pan-cultural in the sense that there are common things across cultures that inspire us, or is it very context-based and based on, you know, region, geography, the stories we tell each other, our race, ethnicity, or how does it work?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've gathered data from 26 countries, both on what produces awe, and then, you know, the subjective qualities of it. Does it involve the chills? And, you know, there's a lot of overlap, and this is important for your audience. We find around the world there are 8 wonders that trigger awe. People's moral beauty, nature, collective effervescence, music, art, spirituality, and then big ideas, epiphanies. Oh my God, I just thought about infinity, you know, and death, life and death. That's pretty universal, but there are variations in patterns. In certain cultures, it's more person-focused. Like China really reveres teachers. And in our stories of awe, those just appear everywhere. In the United States, no one reveres teachers, you know.
I think in Britain, they're exactly the same thing.
It's like a Dickens-like story of, you know, being lost in your work. But, and then US, it's much more about nature. So there's this structure to awe where there's a lot of similarity, and then there's striking cultural variations.
It was fascinating to read across the book, you know, how you captured the different nuances. And one of, I guess, the areas I was curious about is currently, you know, if I think about culturally, mindfulness, we're talking about it, meditation, forest bathing, which you mentioned in the book, you know, the whole notion of how well-being has become part of our day-to-day terminology and discourse. And I'm wondering, is it the zeitgeist that has brought awe into the conversation, or is the zeitgeist there to allow awe to be part of a standard discourse without it being dismissed as cranky or other or marginal, or to that CEO's point, who I imagine won't be a CEO for very much longer, that it's a nice to have rather than something that is actually core to how we must live now if we are to get out of this current fix we're in?
Yeah, I think it is clearly the interest in emotion and well-being has enabled this emergence of awe, but it is different than the other emphases like mindfulness or gratitude that are so well studied and practiced. You know, awe is about the loss of the self and the connecting to community and nature. And clearly, you know, when, especially like I teach young people, they are tired of self-focus and narcissism. They're hungry for community, and they have a different view of nature as something that is imperiled and precious. And so I think awe is really striking a chord with people right now, because it is this emotion that activates tendencies toward community and nature. Unlike a lot of the other, the mindfulness movement doesn't necessarily focus on that. The gratitude movement is really much more social. So I think it's got this timeliness for our current cultural zeitgeist that has been lacking, frankly, that we can return to.
Yeah, I mean, it was fascinating because, you know, as I saw your book coming in, I was reading quite a number of economists who were talking about awe, talking about happiness.
Really?
One of our team here had said, why don't we do a piece on the awe economy? So it's one of those where you realize it's bubbling up, it's coming through the firmament, and then, wow, it's here. And what I was kind of thinking about, currently, there's a downturn in belief in traditional and formal religions on one side, but this upsurge, to your point, in groundswell of belief in nature, in ways we relate to the planet differently. And I'm just wondering, particularly with Gen Z, who you mentioned, and Gen A particularly, because I guess you're teaching, you know, a lot of Gen A students, do you think this is their answer to all of those problematic questions and divisions we have about formal religions, and it's their way of reformulating the big question in a language that we can agree on rather than a language, as most religions do, which caused division and dissent and polarization?
Yeah, it's so fascinating that you observe that because, you know, I'm not a religious person really. And, you know, I had to write a chapter about mystical awe and interviewed fascinating people who know a lot about spirituality. And what has struck me in talking about this book is it opens up new conversations about spirituality. 81% of Americans believe in spirit, and about half of those find it in nature, and they describe it in terms of awe. A lot of people will go to a dance festival and feel this collective effervescence and spirit amongst the people, or a political rally. They're like, God, this is just divine, and that's awe. And awe, like you say, Martin, removes all those thorny terms like God and divine, and it gives us what William James hoped for, the great American philosopher, kind of a pluralistic language for our conversations.
I mean, it's fascinating because I realized when I was writing it, I used capital A. I didn't put it into lowercase, so I used the definitive A.
Good.
And also, I was thinking about years ago, I interviewed E.O. Wilson, publishing
heroes.
A magazine, and he'd mentioned the word consilience, which you will be familiar with.
Yes.
And that whole thing that everything is interrelated and interconnected. And at the time, which I guess was in the, you know, the 90s, it was still seen to be part of a sort of a quack view of science, despite the fact that everything, as we now know, is pointing that way anyway. But I also wonder, is awe allowing us to really encounter and have better language to understand and integrate those big, seemingly difficult moments in our consciousness?
I mean, that is such a profound observation, because there were several moments. One was thinking about wonder and awe, you know, and Descartes and certain others were saying, this is a basic state of mind or consciousness. If consciousness is feeling, awe is a primary feeling about the world. So it is that. And then writers like Rebecca Solnit saying, you know, when I walk in nature, it's like a walking awe form of consciousness. And so that begs your question, which is, you look at 21st century consciousness as narrow, self-focused, individual-focused, and this next generation wants to blow it out, wants to make it systemic and about interconnectedness, which we're seeing in interests in things like quantum physics. And awe is a gateway to that kind of consciousness.
Without a doubt. I was thinking about 18th century enlightenment, how the astrologer, the astronomer, the physicist, the mathematician would all meet and have conversations and didn't really segregate those pathways. It was only probably, I guess, the 19th century specialism, industrialization, that we started pulling these things apart. So my also great hope is that potentially this will begin the movement to pull things back together and to allow, I notice in CERN at the moment, they have poets sitting next to physicists, because he said, actually, poetry is so difficult, it will be easier explained by a physicist, and quantum is so infinitesimally bizarre that a poet will understand it before the average scientist. So I quite like this idea that we're pulling things together, which leads me to this quote. And again, you use in your book, it's Emerson talking about his connections and patterns and his engagements with nature. And the phrase which you use, and I think a lot of people will know it, is this notion of strange symphonies, which is both a beautiful phrase, but I also wanted to kind of ask you to describe your strange symphonies. You know, when you had those moments of awe that really make you think, this book is worth doing, and the insights I'm capturing are not known to many. So what were the kind of strange symphonies that led you to, actually not the book really, because I was looking at your career. It started a long time ago in some ways,
yes, it did.
You know, the other books you've written and the other work you've done.
Yeah, you know, Emerson's Strange Sympathies is just the feelings we have about the transcendent and the mysterious. For me, my whole scientific career has been after that, you know, but most poignantly with respect to awe, I still don't understand how music can make us cry. I still don't understand how when I saw Nelson Mandela come out of prison at this 50,000 person rally, we had rushes of ecstasy and goosebumps, like instantaneously. And then, you know, more proximally for the book, Martin, you know, when my brother passed away, and I'm sort of a evolutionary biology type, and I just sensed spirit around him. And throughout my grief, sense that those are strange sympathies of feelings of oneness with him that I still can't explain. But the beauty of awe and these emotions is they move you forward in seeking to understand them. Yeah, and so thank goodness for that emotion.
It's interesting because, you know, coming from Ireland, when you have death, you have a waking period, which is really about memory and thought and consideration. And you cry, you chat, you remember the stories, but you also do it sometimes in the present tense. You still talk about people as if they're living with us. Then you have, at some point, a memorial to continue the story. And since I've moved to England, I noticed that everybody wants to bury the dead quickly and take them out of sight So there is no sense of awe and despair and grief. And then they want to do a memorial. And I always think, oh, hang on a minute. We're now celebrating without the benefit of tears and without the benefit of meditation.
Stories.
Exactly. And the stories. And really, the other thing that I think came through the book, where you were talking about your brother and all of those things that connected with you, they were hugely emotional. And as a reader, you felt, you weren't just reading the description, you were feeling the emotion. And that was, I guess, one of the other things about awe, as you describe it, that in the end, in some ways, it almost becomes indescribable. You know, there's a moment we can't really communicate the goosebumps or the tingling we feel, because really, it is almost impossible to articulate.
It is. And I think you're right. I mean, I really wrestled with that in the book, Martin. Like, you know, I write about the neurophysiology we've talked about and the measures and the stories and the effects of awe. It makes you feel small and humble and connected. And still, at the end of the book, I'm like, there's some essence to the experience that I can't
capture or, explain.
Can't capture, and that's okay. And in fact, that's the animating purpose of the emotion, is you can't capture it, so we have to keep talking about it and making sense of it and evolving with it. It was a real challenge as a writer to like think I could get there and not, and then think, well, what's the dynamic purpose of this ineffability?
Without a doubt. I mean, it was interesting that as I use that term, awe economy, people go, wow, how does that work then? How would you describe an awe economy? And I would say, well, if you think about how the happiness index became part of a KPI or a measuring system for quite a lot of, not just Western countries, actually, you know, even India, Pakistan, use this term now to describe the net happiness levels of a population. And I'm just wondering, because I know we're getting to that point of the show where I have to get you to think forward a little and go, wow, if we're doing the awe economy or the awe index, how could we start measuring awe as a better, different, more profound way to allow people to be better human beings? I mean, I know it's a big question, but I really think there's an opportunity for governments and businesses and organizations to build awe into how they want us to live and be in the world today.
I think you could extract that from this book, which is, first of all, basic measures of awe should be part of schools and hospitals and, you know, tech firms, just to, because we know it drives innovation and creativity and curiosity. So one of the really interesting applications of this is something I've been thinking about, which is awe design, which is, there are interesting principles or how you would design a product according to awe. It has to have some sort of vast elements and not be expected and be mysterious. And so that is tractable. And I, you know, physical environments, and there is a little bit of work in this in actually the UK about, you can take photographs of any neighborhood or any building or any school or interior setting, and what's called machine learning or classification of it for awe according to its design. And that will prove to be beneficial for people.
It was interesting you know, talked about it in terms of the senses. So, you know, you've got awe, which is inspired by smell, color, sound, light. And I think that to your point about awe-inspiring products, awe-inspiring buildings, you know, more than ever, I think that's what people are asking the questions about. Because
I agree.
If I have to go back to the office, I'm using the inverted comma sign there, if people can't see that, what will make me go back? If I must do this job, why would I do it? If I have to go to this show or the event, what is going to compel me to go there? And if you said awe to all of those things, people go, wow, okay, if I'm going to feel that emotion, I'm there. But, I think a lot of people feel beauty and aesthetics and what I'm going to call the adjectives of living versus the facts, to go back to that terrible CEO who was all about the facts of living, the facts of life, Martin. I go, my God, you know, does this man need to wake up? But what was interesting is that in the end, when a lot of people looked at, when I was chatting with you about this notion of beauty sitting as part of economic measure and awe, they had still hesitations about it. They were still going, we get that, but how would I measure it? How would it work? So just as we kind of come to the end of the show, do you think there are any factors or indicators that you think would help us measure that, either as businesses or as individuals, that would allow us daily to see improvement and daily to see increased value, and then eventually not to challenge the thing, but to just do it?
I mean, you can approach it at many different levels, right? So in the most abstract sense, and Jonah Berger has done this at Penn and Wharton, which is any kind of thing that we create, be it a medicine or an idea in a classroom or a car, can be measured in terms of its awe-inspiring potential, right? Does it have a certain degree of mystery to it? Does it defy our frame of reference? Does it have elements and hints of vastness, of being part of something vast? And Jonah Berger finds, and you know, the people interested in this should be paying attention, like, that is viral. Like, we are moved by that kind of thing, and we share it with others, right? He studies the spread of stories in newspapers and the like. You could very simply, if I were doing consumer testing, if you want to get down to the details like that, ask people, did it give them the chills? Did you go, whoa, you know? But yeah, there are very tractable ways to measure.
Not that I want to measure, because I always think it's a...
I love measurement.
Good. I have to say, the book is also full of great rules, but I think we're small incremental lessons, because I always think with a lot of books I currently read, I think, what are the lessons that settle in and inveigle into my consciousness without me having to kind of memorize them? And I think it did that. I had one final question is, what do you think would be that one thing that you think I should do every day to really activate the awe nerve? I'm going to call it a nerve. It's not really a nerve, but you know what I mean? The awe nerve in my consciousness.
Well, I'll give you two things, and they really surface throughout our science and then in the book. And sorry to give you two. One is to go on a regular walk where you look at the small and the vast and think about your relationship to nature, which people do a lot of, but if you add this perceptual set for awe, it really changes it. And the second is to remember the moral beauty around you. You know, who taught you about courage and kindness? Where do you see it in the streets? And those two things are sure bets to all the benefits of awe.
Perfect, which I think is a good point to end, but also a great point to explain the title of the book, because it is Awe, the Transformative Power of Everyday Wonder, published by Alan Lane, and is available now on both sides of the Atlantic. I've always wanted to say that, but it is now available officially in the UK. And I think there is a French edition. A friend sent me a note from Paris yesterday to say she's about to track it down, pre-order.
Excellent.
So you're coming out in another beautiful language as well. Thank you for joining me. A pleasure to speak. I would love to continue the conversation, so I'm going to do that on my blog. My name is Martin Raymond, and you've been listening to Back to the Future. Yes, that's what it's pronounced as, Back to the Future. So until next time, keep listening, keep looking, keep learning, and of course, keep asking not just what's new and next, but what will inspire you in an awesome way on a daily basis. Thank you.
Thanks, Martin.